Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and Kathleen can unfortunately not be with us today. But we do have a very special guest for you, and his name is Ross Hamilton. He is the author of two books. One of them is The Mystery of the Serpent Mound, but his most recent one is called Star Mounds, Legacy of a Native American Mystery. And Ross, first of all, congratulations on the book, and second of all, congratulations on a beautifully produced book. It is rare to see books being produced well, but I'm very happy to say that this wonderful book is produced wonderfully as well.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you. We worked hard on this. I had some of the finest people at North Atlantic Books. The best of their staff was assigned to help, and we worked on it night and day for months to make sure it would pass all the tests. We made it colorful. We made it a different shape so it would sit in your lap comfortably, and we used different types of type to make it easy to read. And it's just loaded with illustrations, so I think that anybody that picks it up will not be sorry that they did so.
Absolutely not. And actually, you know, I like this format. I've never really considered this format to be ideal to go out in the field with, but I actually think it is. I think this might be the best format of a book to take with you out into the field. It's somehow these pages stay open. Anyway, enough of the practicalities of the book. let's go into the contents of the book. And basically, you are what I would say a premier expert on Serpent Mound. How did you come into the mound culture of America? What fascinates you? What attracts you in it?
Well, the mound culture in America is complex, and it's antique, and it is, well, I'll put it this way. Archaeologists have puzzled over the mound culture, which basically is centered in the Ohio Valley, but spreads throughout most of the eastern United States, parts of Canada. In other words, from New York down to Florida, through the Carolinas, all the way over to the Mississippi Valley. You have a tremendous number of earthworks. Just, some estimate it to be 50,000. But out of those 50,000, there are only about probably a few hundred that weren't designed for burial. They were designed as temple structures. And although they're made of earth, they may not originally have been made of earth. They may have been reconstructed by the people who were buried in the mounds, but we'll get into that a little bit, hopefully, as we move along. I was born in New York City, but very early on, when I was about seven, and I'm in my 60s now, my father, who was an executive with the Form Ica Corporation, had to move to the home office in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is, I guess, about 700 miles from New York City going west. Now, Cincinnati's located right along the Ohio River, and it's practically in the middle of this ancient temple structure, which actually is thousands of square miles throughout the states of Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and West Virginia, and parts of Pennsylvania. Now, when Washington finished the Revolutionary War, he didn't have enough money to pay the men who fought against Cornwallis and the British Empire. And so he promised them 600 to 1,000 acre plots in the new Ohio territory. Now, Ohio is an Iroquois word that means beautiful. And the land indeed was beautiful. And when they were sent over, when the early pioneers came over the Appalachian chain, they found over 50,000 mounds. And in Ohio alone, they counted 10,000. And they actually had to chase out or eliminate the existing native people, the Shawnee and the Miami and parts of the Iroquois and even the Cherokee still lived in that area. And they had to be chased out, and which is a very sad episode in history. But what happened then was they were just marveling at these, but the new relatively uneducated men and women that took over these lands saw the mounds as curious pieces of antiquity, and instead of preserving them, they looted them. After they finished planting their corn and plowing them, they would dig into the burial mounds and try to find things to sell, looking for gold, but they never found any gold. I think they found one or two nuggets of gold out of all the earthworks that they dug up. And as a result of that, by the time I was born and moved to there, most of them had been destroyed. Fortunately, and as you can see in the book, many of the temple structures, the non-burial earthworks, were preserved by map-making expeditions that were launched by private interests in the early 19th century. And they had the surveyor's art down to an excellent science by that time. So fortunately, we have excellent maps. And most of them were published in the early part of the 1800s by the Smithsonian Institute, which, by the way, was funded by a British entrepreneur, a scientist, actually, at the time, Smithson. And it was left as part of his, in part of his will, to help the fledgling United States have their first natural history museum and so forth. So the Smithsonian published these maps, and they went out of copyright, so I was able to use them copyright-free without having to pay anything. And I put them in the computer, cleaned them up, and colorized them, and then we were able to project the stars over them to show that the native people had, through some science that we as yet don't comprehend, developed the ability to produce geometric forms and cultivate astronomical precepts and sciences and mold and meld the two of them together, almost like an alchemy between earth and sky. To create these temples. Now, what's interesting about the collection that was published by the Smithsonian is that after these myths of Atlantis were dispensed by the early science, they believed that these were the creations of the survivors of Atlantis. Science began to do the carbon dating and so forth, and they found that many of these temples were only 2,000 to 3,000 years old, these temple structures. And they attributed them to the people that were buried nearby. But as it turns out, we're now beginning to discover that there was a reclamation project, a sort of rehabilitation project promoted by the native people beginning about 3,000 years ago and ending about 1,500 years ago, that took it upon themselves over the course of those many centuries to very carefully trace the outlines of the foundations of these lost and ruined structures so that we attributed these mathematics and geometrics of Archimedes and the astronomies of on the equivalent of a Kepler to these relatively primitive people that we found buried in the mounds, people that were still engulfed or enthralled in a Stone Age mentality. The noble savage was a good way of describing these people. And in fact, the native people that were met by the first English and Spanish colonists didn't know who created the earthworks. And they were actually their ancestors, but going back over 1,000 years, so that their oral traditions were somewhat fuzzy. And although some of the mythologies did carry the stories of their ancestors, they didn't have a clue, the native people, on who had actually constructed the mounds. They didn't have a name for their people, because so many wars and so many changes and genetics had occurred that it was very difficult even for our science in modern day to trace the DNA of the people buried in the mounds to the modern native people. So that posed a great mystery, and it wasn't until we discovered the star patterns and the archaeoastronomy that we were actually able to date the original designs for these earthworks, which were somewhat muddied because they had been reconstructed by the people who came millennia after their original design.
So how old would you say they are?
Well, by design, they go back between 5,000 and 6,000 years ago, which would put it, of course, 3,000 to 4,000 B.C. Now, that's not old compared to some of the buried structures that they're finding in the sands of the Near East and the Far East, or the underwater structures that have been discovered, you know, post-ice age, post-melting of the glaciers. But nevertheless, these are very, very antique structures. And the reason that they're so interesting to us of this kind of new archaeological mentality is because many of them, like Glastonbury, which is practically lost to archaeological perception, but still alive in the minds and hearts of the poets and the philosophers, and the Elysian Fields, which were once spread out across the archipelago of Greece, and places like the Ohio Valley, places in China where the Forbidden City is now. In very ancient times, there were other structures there. And these places, they were in India, were renowned because they somehow made use of a technology that was attributed by philosophical transmission only to the Atlantean and the Mooian technological societies. And when the oceans raised up, many of these ethereal people, these ethereal countries, had to begin to move into the what they referred to as the lowlands of the Americas, Europe, down into Egypt. There's another former paradisiacal setting. And what they did 10,000 years ago was they constructed these beautiful figures on the landscape throughout South America, Central and North America, throughout Europe, down into the Mediterranean and Africa. And these places were like new Atlantean structures. They were all kind of like colonies, if you will, of Atlantis and Lemuria and Mu. And of course, India and China were more prone toward the Lemurian survivors. But the masters of the time, and I'm a philosophical initiate. I was initiated by a great master saint from India in 1969. And the transmissions that I've gotten through my internal meditations and by word of mouth from many of the saints have enlightened me intellectually to understand that there was a great country in the United States that was formed in the shape of a grand eagle or great phoenix. And when that country fell into ruin because the technology that was used by the post-Atlantean culture was decidedly brought to an end by the masters at the time, because the people, they believed, needed to understand that the Creator lived within them and that these fantastic technologies, which literally transposed the magnetic field of the Earth and its the charged clouds of the sky into this wonderful life force essence that we call the medicine in North America. We call it also chi or prana. It enhanced nature to the point where there were literal paradises at different locations on the Earth. The whole Earth hadn't been etherealized since before the last ice age. We don't know. Probably 50,000 years ago, the planet was very much in the astral world, and some of your listeners will know what I mean by that. We weren't grossly physical. Now we're pretty much at the physical world, And we'd become divorced from that fifth element, that condition of matter that we call the ether. And the etherealization of the planet requires that the magnetic field be completely tapped and utilized and translated with the in its twin aspects of positive earth energy and negative sky energy through the use of this shepherding that we do of this wonderful spiritual science, to the point where the earth is brought up to a higher level of vibration. Now, like I said, this hasn't been the case for many, many thousands of years, long before anyone can remember. But these pockets of paradisiacal use of the energy crop up once every 5,125 years. Now, I can be very specific on that because the Indian culture, who where the seat of spiritual power has been on the planet for the last 5,000 years or so, is moving again back to the Americas. So the Maya, I may sound like I'm rambling a little bit, but I will make a point. The Maya, who are located in Guatemala and Mexico mainly, used to be all through the Americas 5,000 years ago, say that once every 5,125 years, this period of time called the Bactun is completed. And there's a certain number of them that comprise the precessionary period, which is the better part of 26,000 years. And once every Bactun, the Earth experiences a renewal. And this technology of Atlantis, the spiritual technology of Atlantis and Lemuria, is restored to certain places of the planet. And it's bound to be restored again, starting in North America. And the saints say that the seat of spiritual power, the actual axis of spiritual initiation, is moving from the Himalayas to the Andes and the Rockies and North America. And so many of the Indian masters who have been incarnated in India and the Near East and Far East for many, many centuries are going to be incarnating in the Americas now. And, of course, this has been known. The Buddhists are already have been making arrangements to move over here for some time. But the incarnations have already begun, so many of the masters are taking on European and American forms. Some of them actually are Native American. And so the revival of the Star Mounds is slated as one of those events. So this, what this book is trying to emphasize is that 5,000 years ago, or 6,000, between that period of 1,000 years when Eden and the Elysian Fields and the halls of Amenti and Tir na n'og and Glastonbury and so forth were thriving, will again become a reality for people. Now, I'll give you an example of Glastonbury Tor, and we can compare it with Serpent Mound. Glastonbury Tor, of course, was named after the thunder, the god of thunder, Tor, because probably Glastonbury Tor was still receiving lightning strikes when the Vikings invaded, and so they renamed it Thor. But the Tor is really kind of central to the ancient cosmological figure of the Glastonbury Zodiac. And it's believed that when the spiritual technology was all aligned properly and all the figures were properly represented on the landscape at Glastonbury, you had a feeding of the Tor by a gathering of the earth energy. And the Tor acted almost like a communal system where it would receive the energy from the sky by making it very viable, by storing a lot of the earth energy and drawing the earth energy to that point to attract the energy of the sky, which gives us that kind of Ouranos and Gaia relationship, where without the sky spark, you know, the sulfur of the alchemical philosophical stone, and the mercurial aspect of the earth energy, the mother energy, you know, the female energy, you wouldn't be able to create this divine energy that makes things grow and restores health. Now, in the Celtic mythology, you have the legend of the Tuatha De, or the Tuatha De Danann, and the children of the moon. And we have a similar mythology over here, where the Tuatha were supposedly partly a fairy culture. In other words, they were an etherealized culture, which still exists, but has become separated. Because when the temples, when Glastonbury fell, when the Elysian Fields were kind of disconnected, when the halls of the Egyptian gods and the goddesses, when the capstones were removed from the pyramids, and when our Manitous here lost their crystals on their altars and our capstones were removed, immediately a divorce occurred with the fifth element, because it requires a reaction from the pyramids and the Manitous and the temples, a reaction between earth and sky to maintain the ethereal environment. So Avalon's gone, you know, and in the same sense, the happy hunting ground disappeared for the native people, and they lamented that loss. They immediately began to squabble among themselves. What used to be a free society and great country here, in the shape of a great eagle, which head of which was the country of the state of Michigan, and the backbone of which went all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, and the wings stretched into New England and up into the Dakotas. What used to be a great country of Gitche Manitoba, or New Atlantis, and flourished with seven great medicine wheels along the central axis, going from the cities of what Sault Ste. Marie is now, down through Lansing to Cincinnati to Lexington, to the Oak Ridge area, down to Atlanta, Georgia, and into Tallahassee, Florida, all on a perfectly straight north line, used to be the seven great chakras, the seven cities of Gitche Manitoba. And they produced a tremendous amount of this medicine, which etherealized the whole country. It was like a great diadem. And the people there grew to be very tall because they had everything ready for them to enhance their natural DNA to become spontaneously robust. And they say, the native people say, the Cherokee say, that Adam and Eve came from their country. And other things are of great interest, too. They supposedly had gardens in North America, which rivaled any at Glastonbury, or in Egypt, you know, where they could make the rains come when the capstones were on the pyramid. They had these fantastic gardens called the Gardens of Edina, which is the same root as the word for Eden, that were incorporated into usually three kind of melded geometric forms. Like oftentimes, as you'll see in the book, the star patterns were made to fit into a square and a circle, or two circles in a square, which were designed to fit together to hold a certain magical proportions, like the golden mean and so forth. And they would have a pyramidal structure which would process the energies of earth and sky. And then from the square, which held the pyramidal structure, they would pump that energy into the round structures where they have these beautiful gardens. And they grew vegetables and fruits and all kinds of different vegetations to heights and qualities that we can only dream about today. They were truly gigantic and truly nourishing. And the people ate these fruits and nuts, and they literally extended their lives to many centuries. And our native people still have legends. They say, our forefathers lived to be centuries old, but they stopped because the white European invaders, of course I'm pro-native, you can tell, my forefathers, I'm white, didn't listen to Guianese. They thought of them as filthy savages. And in fact, the native people were only following the directions of their forebears, saying, live naturally and the Creator will provide for you. Well, after the crystals and the capstones were removed, the same thing happened. Their society deteriorated. Now, there was a whole race of very tall people that lived here, and we discovered their bones when we began to dig into the mounds after the Revolutionary War. They had a genetic base, Philip, no exaggeration, in 7 feet and robust of stature. We found many skeletons that exceeded 7 feet, 7.5, 8 feet. We even found a few that were over 8 feet in height, and not suffering from acromegaly, you know, the disease of gigantism, of like Andre the Giant suffered from, and Yao Ming, who plays with the Houston Rockets here in the United States, basketball star, Chinese guy. Well, he has the same disease, like an overworking of the pituitary gland. And what happens is they grow to be very tall and robust. Usually, sometimes their hands are distended and they look a little strange. They get really deep voices, the men do. But they die by the time they're 35 or 37, which is what happened to Andre the Giant. You might remember him. He's a wrestler, 7.5 feet tall. He was starred in The Princess Bride. Really a lovely fairy tale movie. But these people didn't have acromegaly. We checked out their skeletons, and they were naturally like that. And so although the Smithsonian dug up 7 or 8 of these skeletons and took them back to Washington, because of a policy of Indian inferior status, Indian hatred, they deny that the Indians had a superior race, and so all the skeletons had been mysteriously lost. But we do have the records of them, and then as late as the 1950s, they were still being unearthed by scholars out of the University of Kentucky, the Carnegie Institute, to name a couple. And so we do have it in the archaeological record. But these people were actually descendants from this former paradisiacal culture that lived as a result of their having used that spiritual technology. And what I'm going to speculate and say to your audience is that between 5,000 years ago and 6,000 years ago, a mysterious period, because that's when history seems to begin for us, about 5,000 years ago, but just before history seems to have begun, there seems to have been a much higher mentality and spirituality among many groups of people located in small pockets of influence in different parts of the world.
I mean, absolutely. And when you were talking, one of the thoughts which came to my mind was the story by Frank Walters, who wrote the Book of the Hopi, which is a very controversial book, because basically he, you know, relates encounters which he had with people from the Hopi, and who he said spoke out in confidence to him. And then later, pretty much both Hopi and archaeologists attacked him for saying, well, we can't find these people who you spoke to. But they have this very interesting story, which is basically that they somewhat look down upon the Mayans of Central America, because they believe that actually the beautiful culture of their race was North America, that these tribes walked around America and went from place to place and would visit and revisit temporarily some of the structures. And I'm just wondering, A, whether you have looked into that, and B, whether you think that this mound culture is potentially a part of that as well.
Yes. The mound culture is kind of complicated. It spreads out over a couple thousand years. There were mounds made more toward the central part of the country, like Cahokia. But Cahokia, which is celebrated in St. Louis, was a much, much later mound culture. And they actually are practically historic. They were just a few centuries before the first Spanish came. But the mounds we're talking about in the Ohio Valley were reconstructed from earlier designs going back to that time that I talked about, between 5,000 and 6,000 years ago. Now, the Hopi are a much-loved and much-celebrated group of people, but they live in the far western United States. And although they do have some knowledge of the eastern United States, they mostly are very spiritual, and they confine their sort of their physical reconnaissance to their general area, along with a few other western tribes. So the east and the west were very much separated in the old days. And there are stories of tribes that moved from west to east that encountered around 1200 BC a race of giants. Now, the tribe that left the far western United States was called the Lenni Lenape. They later called themselves the Delaware when they reached the East Coast. And they were, in their recording, they were astonished to report that when they crossed over the Mississippi, they encountered a race of supermen called the Alleghenies, after which the Allegheny Mountains were named. And they said that the tallest of the Lenape only came up to the shoulders of the Alleghenie women. And the men were 8 feet tall and more, and the women were 7 feet tall and more, and we found their skeletons. So that race, the race that inhabited Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and Illinois, and Pennsylvania, and part south, the eastern part of the United States, that race of people were part of a genetic strain and part of a super race that once lived, 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, and yet their descendants were still here when the Lenape came and started to battle with them for that area. Which, by the way, they succeeded at doing. They absorbed the Alleghenie, and that gave rise to the final hybrid race, which had giants among them, called the Adena people, which we named because we didn't know what their names were. So when the Hopi talk about the histories, they really get into a spiritual bend with it. And, you know, the Hopi are very much compared to the Tibetans. For some reason that nobody has been able to explain, except through spiritual kinship, through their meditations, they have a karmic connection with Tibet. They have many of the same customs, and yet there's no migration story of the Hopi coming from Upper China, Mongolia, that area. So there's a real mystery with them, and they're considered to be like the seers of the Western tribes in the United States. Now, they don't really look down on the Maya so much as the fact that the Maya want to be more recognized by the Hopi, because the Hopi said, in what we call here in the United States, the catbird's heat, which is a place where they have the bully pulpit. The Hopi are very much respected because they tapped into the white man's kind of power source. But the Maya are very much a poor and neglected but very strong folk tradition all through northern parts of South America and Mexico and into southern United States. And so although the Maya do indeed have their own tradition, which stretches back many thousands of years, they haven't been given as much recognition in the press as the Hopi have. So we have some Maya visit the Serpent Mound, three Mayan elders, and they're very interesting. They say the Serpent Mound is Quetzalcoatl, the original, because it holds the ket, the oval of the universe, in its mouth. So they say it's the Quetzalcoatl, and that they lived in Ohio once long ago when it was a paradise. And when the paradise with Gitche Manitoula fell, they moved to the southwest and then into a warmer climate, which is more suited because weather is controlled when you have the spiritual technology working. You can make the rain go and come. And I know you have some listeners that are saying, well, how do you do that? You know, that sounds ridiculous. Well, we haven't quite gotten to that point where we can manipulate the weather, but it was pretty much put out that if the capstone and the power were restored to the Great Pyramid, it would begin to process the cloud structures from the four directions. And when you can pull the moisture, you know, to a single monument from hundreds of miles or thousands of miles from all directions, you begin to control the weather. And so that's why many believe that what Herodotus said about Egypt was true, that when the capstone was on the Great Pyramid and the subsequent pyramids, that indeed the that desert area was all thriving without irrigation because they got plenty of rain. And the other interesting thing, Philip, is when you have that reaction going between earth and sky, you produce a tremendous amount of that fifth element that we all need in our constitutions. We have the fiery element in our metabolism. We have the watery element in the fluids of our bodies. We have the solid element in our bones. And we have the air element in our respiration. You know, we oxygenate our blood. But like so many, like so much of the creation, we lack in that fifth element because we don't breathe enough. And from India, we hear that the physical body, the gross physical body, is called the Anamaya Kosha. The Anamaya Kosha is the physical body, which is obvious to all of us. But just within us, in a subtle body, that we actually draw substance from when we breathe, is called the Pranamaya Kosha, which looks just like us. But it's the ghost body, you know. It's the, you know, like when somebody suddenly dies in a car crash or they die unhappy, you might see their ghosts, and that's the Pranamaya Kosha. Now, the Pranamaya Kosha and the Anamaya Kosha should be integrated. But we fail to breathe. Now, in the old days, when the paradises were here, there was so much ether that people just breathed normally, and the Anamaya Kosha and the Pranamaya Kosha merged, and therefore people lived to be very old, and they became very healthy. And they became very wise, too. The intelligence is increased. You become closer to the subtler body yet, which is called, I shouldn't even mention it because it gets very subtle. But the Pranamaya Kosha has a body inside it that is as subtle to the Pranamaya Kosha as the Pranamaya Kosha is to the physical body, the Anamaya Kosha. And that's called, it's called the causal. In India, I believe they call it the Vidya Maya Kosha or something like that. But we are creatures of spiritual ascendancy. We've forgotten to breathe, and we've forgotten the spiritual technology. So the masters, the saints of India, who have integrated themselves, speak out, and they say to us that we must learn the internal science. We must learn to breathe properly and to integrate ourselves with the sound current within, and we eventually should reintegrate our environment. So we need to do a service to ourselves, and we need to do a service to the land again. And so as we get into this new Bhaktan, starting in 2012, we begin a new Bhaktan. The Indian holy scene is reincarnating in the form of Americans, and we're going to reinstate for a 1,000-year period the Garden of Eden. And it's going to start here in the West. And it's already in the fake karma, so everybody can relax, even though the governments and the naysayers of the world are going to say, oh, that's ridiculous, you know, we can't have that. There's going to be a big spirit, well, your show signifies it, spiritual revolution. And it's truly happening now, Philip. It's starting, actually, some say it's starting with the Venus transit officially. But unofficially, for the most of us, it's going to start on December 21st of this year. We'll call that the period of absolute turnover and transition. And yes, we will, when we integrate, we will have contact with our brethren and sisters who already are in the fifth dimension, the fifth element, because as we integrate with the etheric world again, we will begin to see these temples reappear, Atlantis and so forth, and the, you know, the missing parts of our physical world will begin to come back. And yes, we will see vehicles begin to become more easily seen because they're already here. We just can't see them. There's a tremendous amount of traffic, what we call UFOs, going on in trade and in normal day-to-day movement right now that most people are blind to. But people with, if they're a visionary, people who watch the sky will see so-called UFOs, and some of them are very playful. And they have people in them just like us. As a matter of fact, another interesting thing that I learned from my master is that the whole universe is populated by the same kind of form in different races that we have. So those of you who are fans of Star Trek, which prefers to have mainly man-shaped people on all the planets, that's very true, because the universe, the great omniverse, was created by the great creator in the form of the anthropocosmic being. So the human race is just one, and we have several sub-races here. We have the yellow race and the black race and the white race and the tan race. And we're just one very small subset of people. And that, you know, Mars, Venus, all of the planets, and this, of course, sounds off, but when we reintegrate with the fifth dimension, we begin to make friends again with the Martians and the Venusians. But we're the only planet in our section of space that has actually made the gross physical habitable. We have a wonderful balance here that's been maintained by our magnetic field, and because we have in the past, created a lovely environment that was so balanced that even when we became divorced from the fifth dimension, we still were able to hold life in the highest sense. Now, people are not very well off here. People are not happy. And that's why we want to reintegrate. And so the ascension of the Earth, so to speak, is in the works, and it's all happening.
Well, I mean, what I like about Starmounts is that you sit within a tradition of books which have been roughly appearing since the early 1990s, which is beginning to show that an awful lot of the buildings on Earth, whether they are the pyramids of Egypt, whether they are Teotihuacan, whether they are the Inca civilization, that all of these cultures looked towards the skies and saw things in the skies and reproduced them and built their buildings in accordance with what they saw in the sky. Now, there are some global, I would say, preferences for certain constellations. Orion is definitely one of them. The Pleiades is another. How did you find the interest of the mound builders to be? Do they fit within the general pattern elsewhere? Are there certain specifics? Or did they go for a more universal approach in the sense that they might have decided to map the entire sky on that region of the Earth?
Well, you know, that's really a good question, and I probably wouldn't have covered it unless you had asked me, because I'm so so headstrong about this other ideas that I have. But yeah, in the book, I show how I compare, you know, our route to Glastonbury, and in Glastonbury, the 12 houses of the zodiac and some of the northern constellations have been highlighted by scholars. But in the Ohio Valley, it appears that they went to a great deal of trouble and they mapped the entire night sky virtually down to the South Pole, which was something that astonished me and my wife when we were doing this research, and my colleagues that helped out. I wasn't an astronomer when I started this, but now, you know, there's 88 constellations filled, and we found that the native people here covered every part of the night sky that our modern astronomers cover. Now, the constellations aren't exactly the same, but in many cases, they are roughly the same because the science that they had apparently was based upon the ecliptic plane, which is where the sun rises, and what we call where the gravitational pull of the Earth is toward the sun. Now, all the planets are on the ecliptic plane, and the 12 houses, or 13, of the zodiac are the stars that fall where the sun rises. Now, there's much science to this, but essentially, the sky was divided into 12 parts, and they divided it back according to the brightest stars, which is what we've done. And so many of the constellations you'll see in star maps correspond to what we consider constellations of today, which makes it much easier to understand when you read the book. And you can say, oh, yeah, there's Orion, there's Aries, and there's the Pleiades. And so the people here 5 to 6,000 years ago, as though they could be chuckling at us right now, in some way had such an insight on the proper way to segment the sky that they sort of dished it up, and it made it very easy for me to rediscover, because in the beginning I thought this would be impossible. Even if these earthworks were ascribed certain star structures, archaeologists would have us believe they were made by three different races that had no contact with each other. So how would I even begin? Well, as it turned out, that's how we came across the theory. But they were all made at the same time, but they were ruined, fell into ruins, and then successive cultures came and rehabbed them. And so they were all designed at the same time, and they apparently were so astute and brilliant at their analysis of the sky that we're just now catching up with them. And I fortunately, with a lot of good luck and help from some good people, were able to show this. So get this book, people. Check this book out. You will not believe the good luck that we had in mapping out the sky and matching it up with the ancient earthworks.
And I mean, that's not the total extent to which you go. You also find that pretty much the stories of the Native Americans coincides with some of the things you find in the mounts, or associated with the mounts and associated with the star lore, which really shows you that when white men decided to wipe this out roughly two centuries ago, pretty much the entire story survived, and it's still there, touchable. It's quite remarkable to see that despite disregard of mainstream media, and specifically mainstream archaeology, who really, in my opinion, treat this culture not necessarily with disdain, but definitely try to pretend it doesn't really happen.
That's what they did, Philip, and they do it to this day. You know, I have some friends that are archaeologists, but with my first book, when that got released, it was pretty much snubbed because I got just a little bit esoteric with it. I ascribed the Serpent Mound to having a star pattern. That was ridiculous. We know the native people weren't that bright, they told me. They were just primitive savages. And as a result of that way of thinking, we wiped out the native people and tried to get them to speak English only. We did lose a tremendous number of the stories. And so as a result of that, I had to go into at least 5 tribal national traditions, going back thousands of years through different languages, and researching many dozens of texts in order to piece together a common mythology that all of these tribes, which I'll reiterate, were separated by the white man, all these tribes once had. And so, there was once a single mythology, and we can show now that that mythology was based upon 70 or 80 beautiful earthworks spread out just a few thousand square miles, centered upon the Serpent Mound in Adams County, Ohio. And that when you put them all together, all of the earthworks, and they're separated on the Earth according to water sources. So they don't follow the pattern like at Glastonbury. Everything is contiguous with a nice sky. No, that's not what they did here. They actually separated the houses of the zodiac so they could be where the lightning struck the most and where the best water sources were, so that each house of the zodiac had its own ego and was able to process its own energies and make its own medicines. And it wasn't until we discovered it that we were able to place these ancient temples in the sky and show how they were originally designed, and then each one was separated and placed in different areas. So we might have the constellation earthwork that corresponds with Pisces is actually 60 miles south of the one that corresponds with Aquarius. Although their architectures, which you can see in the back of the book in Matches Made in Heaven, you can see that their architectures are next to each other in the night sky. But they were separated where they got the best access to lightning and water. So you see, there is a certain practicality. And so each temple became ascribed to a different clan or tribe. And so there were 60 or 70 star tribes or star families that all would convene probably at different times of the year. And when their culture became so strong and powerful that they produced the great medicine, according to the mythology, the serpent, which was called Gitche Manitou, the great spirit, Gitche Manitou, the serpent rose up from Ohio to Michigan and took its place on the uraeus of the grand man and activated the seven great medicine wheels, and the country of Gitche Manitouba was born. Gitche Manitouba, the country of the great spirit. And so when the founding fathers of the United States came, they inherited this wonderful lore, and they literally conceived the seal of the United States of America upon the words of the native elders. So you have the great seal, you know, the great eagle, the head, the state of Michigan, and so forth. And on the obverse part of the great seal is that wonderful pyramid with the all-seeing eye, which we now know is at the head end of the great serpent. The great serpent, according to Cherokee mythology, had a sun disk on its oval, and that sun disk was powered by this jewel called the Olanyasut. That's out of the native Cherokee Iroquoian tongue. And the Olanyasut was a pure crystal, transparent, with a single blood-red streak running through it like a filament. And it took the energy from the sky and the energy from the earth, and it sat atop this pyramid. And it translated those two currents into a lamp that was so brilliant that the native people could see into the etheric world, into the, you know, what we call the fairy world or the happy hunting ground. And they could literally walk because they had a lamp. They could walk into the paradise of Eden. Now, according to the legend, when the crystals, and there were many shards of them, each of the temples, each of the families, and each of the star temples had a shard of the Olanyasut, and each one was held by its medicine. And they picked up the energy from the central shard, the central jewel. And when the shards were removed from the various altars, and each one had its own power source, so like radio and TV, they could tap into the central. And the serpent mount, of course, is central in the night sky, constellation Draconis at the North Pole, and central to the cosmography of the Ohio Valley. Then all of these places fell into darkness, but the great country of Gitche Manitouba was born as a result of that. So we hear the legend of the phoenix coming out of the worm. So it's said that when the worm containing all the knowledge of the parent rose up, it became the phoenix. And I think we're out of time. But
Well, we have a few more minutes, and maybe we should give people some homework, because all of these sites are in the United States, and most of our audience is in the States. So if they want to meet the mound culture face-to-face or face-to-mount, what would be your absolute favorites to for somebody to basically get in their cars and dash out and meet some mounts?
Well, we hope to see you here, Philip, when you get a chance. But there's a few earthworks that are still there that you can see that are really, even the white man couldn't destroy these because they were so beautiful. One is sacred to the constellation Scorpius. It's called Fort Ancient, and it's in southern Ohio, just off Interstate 71, and it's accessible to tourists. And it's titanic in size. It's so large that it can contain several soccer stadiums in it. And it's sacred, like I said, to the constellation Scorpius, and holds, and it's one of those featured in the books, Of course, the one that I love everybody to visit and is a visitor's park is Serpent Mound. And my wife and I are there on Saturdays, usually, or Sundays, so we'd love for you to come and meet us. We'll give you a tour around the mound. And you can visit the museum, and I'll tell you all about the Star Mounds if you come. So visit Serpent Mound. It's located in Adams County, and it's very easy to access, and it's out in the wilderness area, so there's just farms surrounding it, pretty much like Fort Ancient. And then the third one is up toward Newark, Ohio, which is north of us, north of Serpent Mound. And it's actually a 9-hole golf course. It's the remainder of the Newark complex. And it's composed of a great octagon with a neck and a circle. And you can only go there, I believe, on Mondays or Tuesdays. But any day of the week, you can stand outside and get a glimpse of parts of it. It's so large that you can hardly see it. But they made a finely manicured golf course out of it, and it's kind of privately owned. Actually, all of them are semi-privately owned, but two of them are parks that you can visit. And those are the ones that I would recommend the most, because the rest are either burial mounds or kind of semi-private and not really very easily accessible or in complete ruins. So,
and I think that's the unfortunate thing, that so much of this has been destroyed, but fortunately some of it remains. And as you say, before the Smithsonian decided to change its policies, it actually decided to map all of these things in great detail, and it's a great legacy for us, and was also the tools you were allowed to work with in creating this book. This book, by the way, which is called Star Mounts, Legacy of a Native American Mystery. The author is Ross Hamilton. You can get it wherever books are sold. And the publisher is North Atlantic Books. If you want to listen to this show again, you can also go to a number of ways. One of them is iTunes, where you can listen to approximately 18 months of our shows. You can listen to thespiritrevolution.com, where there are the last 5 of our shows always archived. And you can go to BBS Radio Archives at bbsradio.com, where all of our shows are archived. However, to get access to the archives, you need to pay a small fee, not just for us, but for the entire shows which are aired on the BBS Radio Network to be visited and consulted there. We will be back next week with another show, but in the meantime, from Kathleen in absentia and me here, the truth against the world.